Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Spain arrests 8 suspected Islamist militants with ties to the Islamic State group, the Interior Ministry announced in a statement Friday. The 6 men and 2 women were accused of being part of a network planning terrorist attacks in Spain and recruiting fighters to send to Syria and Iraq. The group represented a serious, definite, and continuing threat to national security, said the statement. All 8 of the people detained are Spanish nationals. 5 of them are of Moroccan origin. Iraqi security forces on Friday pressed on with their massive offensive to retake Tikrit, where fighters from the Islamic State group have reportedly begun to lose ground. Baghdad officials continue to express confidence they will soon completely retake the city, which has strategic and symbolic value as the hometown of former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. As many as 30,000 Iraqi troops and Iranian-backed Shiite militia members have surrounded the city and retaken several areas, though it remains unclear how far the forces have reached. An American health worker infected with Ebola while working in Sierra Leone has been admitted to the National Institutes of Health's hospital in Maryland for treatment. Officials said the patient who had volunteered to treat Ebola patients in Sierra Leone arrived at the NIH facility early Friday after being flown in isolation on a chartered plane. The person will stay in a secure treatment center designed to treat the most dangerous pathogens. NIH officials have not released any information about the identity of the patient. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Egypt for an economic summit aimed at attracting more foreign investment to the politically troubled country. The 3-day conference is being held amid heavy security in the Sinai Peninsula's Red Sea resort city of Sharm el-Sheikh. The region is home to an insurgency that has helped cripple the Egyptian economy. Sinai-based militants who claim allegiance to the Islamic State group have carried out a series of attacks since former President Mohamed Morsi was ousted in a coup in 2013. The U.S.-based human rights group says travel restrictions imposed by the government of Ukraine are seriously delaying delivery of medical help to rebel-controlled areas in the eastern part of the country. HRW said in a statement Friday its conclusion was based on 10 days of telephone and in-person interviews with both medical workers and patients in eastern Ukraine. Human Rights Watch said restrictions have delayed deliveries of medications, causing shortages at clinics and hospitals in the east. Swedish prosecutors are seeking to question WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in London on allegations of sexual misconduct, potentially breaking a stalemate in the nearly 5-year-long investigation. Assange sought refuge in Ecuador's embassy in 2012 when British courts said he could be extradited to Sweden for allegations of sexual misconduct. The Australian former journalist fears Sweden would hand him over to the United States, where he would likely face trial for one of the largest leaks of classified material in U.S. history. U.S. President Barack Obama has denounced the shooting of 2 police officers in racially charged Ferguson, Missouri, calling it a criminal act.
Whoever fired those shots shouldn't detract from the issue. They're criminals. They need to be arrested.
He spoke Thursday night on a U.S. television late night program, saying there is no excuse for the shooting. Earlier, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder said this about the shooting in Ferguson.
This was a damn punk, who was trying to sow discord in an area that is trying to get its act together and trying to bring together a community that has been fractured for too long.
The shooting came just hours after the city's police chief resigned in the wake of a Justice Department report accusing the department of racially biased policing. And 4 identical spacecraft were launched late Thursday from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida. They will study the powerful magnetic fields that surround our planet. I'm Bob Doty reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Ruhib, and coming up at this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Albino people in Malawi are in a state of fear after a recent spate of attacks. Some have been abducted, others killed, their body parts removed.
That's Lamek Masina reporting from Blantyre. Details coming up.
Also in the news, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Egypt for an economic summit aimed at attracting more foreign investment to the politically troubled country.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Cameroon military sources say Boko Haram fighters have killed civilians in four Nigerian villages of Shuwa Arabs. The militants claim these residents supported Chad government units that had driven Boko Haram units from towns along Lake Chad. Major Balthus Kwene called the reprisal a massacre strategy by the insurgents. Cameroon authorities say more than 10,000 Shuwa Arabs in Nigeria have fled across the border into Cameroon in recent weeks. Most of the refugees are women and children. Meanwhile, the bulk of Chadian troops has withdrawn from Gambaru in Nigeria and moved to Fartikol in Cameroon. The force has turned south to Banki in a possible effort to retake Bama, the second largest city in Nigeria's Borno state.
Nigeria's defense headquarters claims they have chased Boko Haram fighters out of all towns they occupied in Adamawa state. However, there is no independent confirmation of that report. Chadian troops are reported battling Boko Haram fighters to the north along the Niger border. Boko Haram's six-year campaign to create a caliphate in northern Nigeria has led to thousands of deaths and the displacement of more than 1.5 million Nigerians. The leader of the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq has accepted a pledge of allegiance from Boko Haram's leader in Nigeria, Abubakar Shekau. The spokesman for the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, has proclaimed the allegiance of Boko Haram as another opportunity for jihad for those who can't get to Tikrit. That city is the site of efforts by government and revolutionary forces from Iraq and Iran to retake the city of Tikrit. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council is expected to vote next week on endorsement and possible financial support for an 8,700 regional force now fighting in West Africa against Boko Haram.
The Islamic State group has accepted Boko Haram's pledge of allegiance, confirming the Nigerian militant sect as its newest affiliate. What does this mean for U.S. military assistance in the fight against Boko Haram? VOA West Africa correspondent Ann Look reports.
Boko Haram's allegiance to the Islamic State militants raised the question of whether the U.S. military will target the Nigerian sect for attack. A U.S. congressional committee asked U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter during a hearing on the president's proposed authorization for the use of military force against Islamic State.
This is really focused on ISIL and the associated forces there. When they engage in operations against us or our coalition partners, as the text says, and that can be interpreted, but has not yet been interpreted to cover other groups like Boko Haram.
For the past decade, the United States military has kept a light footprint in Africa. The strategy has been to bolster local militaries to fight terrorism themselves. Analysts say that is unlikely to change. U.S. assistance has included training, such as the Flintlock exercises. This year's regional exercise just wrapped up in Chad and included regional troops headed off to fight Boko Haram inside and along the borders of Nigeria as part of an ongoing regional offensive. But military cooperation between the U.S. and Nigeria has appeared strained in the past year. Nigerian officials have criticized the U.S. for what they say is refusal to sell military equipment to Nigeria. Nigeria cut off U.S. training of a Nigerian Special Forces unit in December. Analysts say U.S. options have been limited by the Leahy Amendment, a law that prohibits direct assistance to units implicated in human rights abuses. The U.S. has objected to Nigeria's military-focused response to the insurgency, calling instead for a holistic approach to address root political and economic causes. CNA Corporation, a nonprofit research and analysis firm that advises the U.S. military, issued recommendations this week that the U.S., in the short term, instead help Nigeria's neighbors on regional containment efforts. Senior CNA research scientist Julia McQuaid says the U.S. has been trying and failing to win Nigeria over to its way of thinking.
And so I think one of the points that we try to make is the U.S. government barking up the wrong tree, so to speak, to continue trying to affect change within Nigeria, with the Nigerian leadership?
But CNA and other analysts agree that in the long term, Nigeria must lead the effort to permanently dismantle Boko Haram. The Africa Center director at the Atlantic Council in Washington, J. Peter Pham, says it's time for some, quote, real politic on the U.S. side.
Look, is the Nigerian government perfect? Clearly not. Are there things we would wish were different or better? Certainly. But at the end of the day, this is one of the largest, most effective groups that's declared its allegiance to the Islamic State.
But what does Nigeria want? At a forum in Washington this week, the Atlantic Council hosted Nigeria's top intelligence officials, who called on the U.S. to share information and surveillance, or ISR, faster. Nigeria's Chief of Defense Intelligence, Rear Admiral Gabriel E. Okoye.
They fly all over these areas, and that's where my problem comes in. If there is a linkage that from what you are saying from your ISR, we are going to see in real time, it will help us a lot. But there's nothing of that nature. It is a day after that, 24 hours after that, that we get information, oh, this is what we saw. That is the problem.
Analysts have pointed to concerns of intelligence leaks within the Nigerian security forces. On military training, the U.S. ambassador to Nigeria told VOA that talks are underway to resume training, but said they are in the early stages. Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Egypt for an economic summit aimed at attracting more foreign investment to the politically troubled country. The three-day conference is being held amid heavy security in the Sinai Peninsula's Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. The region is home to an insurgency that has helped cripple the Egyptian economy. Sinai-based militants who claim allegiance to the Islamic State group have carried out a series of attacks since former President Mohamed Morsi was ousted in a popularly backed military coup in 2013. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is trying to demonstrate he can limit the violence and attract foreign investors who have shied away from the country because of the political unrest. Hundreds of business leaders and officials are attending the much-hyped international conference, including the top diplomats from the U.S. and the European Union and representatives from major companies, including British Petroleum.
The European Union has announced a pilot effort to dismantle human trafficking of African migrants. Interior ministers meeting in Brussels yesterday said EU immigration officers will set up a project in Niger to screen applicants from Niger, Tunisia, Morocco, and Egypt. The ministers also discussed further examination of the needs of potential immigrants from other African countries. They debated increased funding of their new Frontex border control program, in which the numbers of migrants from the Western Balkans has increased. Italian Interior Minister Angelino Alfano says the proposal is designed to screen potential immigrants and thwart an illegal trade centered in Libya. Last year, traffickers transported more than 276,000 migrants to Europe in vessels that were not seaworthy. Hundreds died of drowning and hypothermia as vessels and rafts capsized in the Mediterranean. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15.580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Cameroon military sources say Boko Haram fighters have killed civilians in four Nigerian villages. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Egypt for an economic summit aimed at attracting more foreign investment to the politically troubled country. And the European Union has announced a pilot effort to dismantle human trafficking of African migrants and would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Well, albino people living in Malawi are in a state of fear after a recent spate of attacks. Some have been abducted, others killed, and their body parts removed. Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
About 15 albinos have been reported abducted and killed since January in various parts of the country, many of them in the eastern district of Machinga. Gideon Nahum is the officer in charge at Machinga Police Station.
Machinga is still continuing receiving reports of attacking and kidnapping of people born with albinism. As of yesterday, we had also received a certain case from Nayuchi that a two-year-old girl was kidnapped. Fortunately, members of the general public assisted until the kidnappers dropped the child.
Nahumu said about 13 suspects have been arrested in connection with the incidents in the district. Attacks on albinos have also occurred in southern districts of Mulanje, Nsanje and Chikwawa, as well as in the Blanta and Cheu district of central Malawi. Albino people whose skin appears pale because of lack of a pigment are targeted in the belief that potions made from their body parts bring good luck and wealth. Chairperson of the Association of Persons with Albinism in Malawi, Boniface Massa, says the development has ignited fear among albinos.
Our major concern is the security aspect. Most of us, we are now living here. We can't do our things freely because we are not sure who to trust, even our own relatives, our own neighbors.
Massa says in areas where cases of kidnapping are rampant, children with albinism have stopped going to school, while women with albinism are staying indoors. Enifa Foster is a resident of Makunami village in the southern district of Chiladzulu. She told VOA the incidents have forced her to carry her three-year-old albino granddaughter wherever she goes. She says she makes sure that she is with her granddaughter wherever she goes, and she even don't allow her to pray at neighbors' houses, as was before the incidents. When she goes to the church, she says she carry her on her back and drop her at school and bring her home herself after classes. Ian Simbora is the national coordinator for the Albino Clinic at Queen Elizabeth Central Hospital in Blanta. He told VOA that fewer people with albinism come to the clinic to get free sunscreen. He says without the lotion, they are risking their lives to skin cancer.
Every week, I have to have people, not less than 15 going up, that come to benefit from the service that we give to people. But just 3 to 4 weeks ago, I've come to realize that patients that I've seen, they're not more than 10. And everybody who comes here would always tell me, we are afraid to even move out. Even some, they even told me that they are not even allowing children to go to school.
Minister of Home Affairs and Internal Security, Pochi Bingu, says there are not enough police officers to protect people in their homes. Chibingu adds the government has strengthened community policing, knowing that those who are involved in the kidnappings live in the community. In a Tuesday statement on the surge in violence against people with albinism in Malawi and elsewhere, the UN High Commissioner for the Human Rights, Zaid Rad Al Hussein, asked authorities to prevent the attacks and bring perpetrators to justice. Lamik Masina for VOA News, Blank.
The West Africa Ebola outbreak has now officially claimed over 10,000 lives among more than 24,000 cases reported. However, the new World Health Organization announcement also says infection rates have fallen in recent week. Guinea and Liberia reported 116 cases last week, a slight drop from the week before. Most cases were found in, on, or around the capital cities Conakry and Freetown. Liberia, which suffered more than 4,000 deaths in the epidemic, reported no new cases for the second week in a row. The director of the UN Development Program, UNDP, estimates the region will lose $15 billion in revenues from trade, investment, and tourism in the next 3 years. UNDP's Africa director, Abdoulaye Mardie, says the business consequences of the stigma of Ebola and an aversion to health risks are vast. One expert translated those figures into stark terms. Families will be unable to put food on the table for 15 days of every year for the next 3 years.
Opposition lawmakers in Zimbabwe stormed out of parliament this week after debate was blocked on a pro-democracy activist who was abducted Monday. Civic organizations say they are shocked that African states have remained silent on the disappearance of Atai Dzamara. Rights groups plan to ask the African Union and Southern African Development Community to remove President Robert Mugabe from chairing those bodies if his government does not act on the disappearance. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
Zimbabwean police say the wife of Dzamara last saw her husband when five men forced him into a car before driving off on Monday. Since then, the opposition and civic organizations have been accusing President Mugabe's government of being behind the abduction. This is because the activist had been staging protests to force Zimbabwe's 91-year-old leader to step down for failing to prop up the country's economy. In Parliament this week, Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa denied allegations that Harare had an issue with the missing activist.
We are a democratic society, and anybody in this country who commits crime must account for the crime they commit. This is why we have the institution of Zimbabwe Republic Police to deal with those who commit crimes of this nature.
On Friday, a High Court judge ordered Zimbabwe security agents, including the police, to ensure that the missing Dzamara is released or brought to court. That followed an application by Zimbabwe lawyers for human rights who are leading efforts to locate Dzamara. Simeon Mawanza of Amnesty International says there is every reason to worry about the missing Dzamara, despite assurance from Vice President Mnangagwa that the abductors will be brought to account.
Zimbabwe has a history of abductions, and most of them were politically motivated. In 2008, dozens of Zimbabweans were abducted mainly for their political activism. Some were found dead, others were seriously tortured.
One of those lucky to be alive is Justina Mukoko, the head of Zimbabwe Peace Project, a civic organization that documents cases of human rights abuses. In December 2008, Mukoko was abducted from her home under the cover of darkness and spent 3 weeks in an undisclosed location where she was routinely tortured by state security agents. Mukoko says the abduction of Dzamara has been very unsettling for her.
I think for me it's really frightening that after my case, the government would actually continue to abduct people in the same way that they have abducted Itai Dzamara. I cannot express the fear that I've got in me, because it's like I'm walking the same route that I walked from the 3rd of December 2008.
Mukoko is part of the group that wants to approach regional bodies such as SADC and the African Union to dethrone Mr. Mugabe if Dzamara is not found. Mr. Mugabe is the current chairman of both bodies. The civic organizations noted that no African government has voiced concern over the missing activist. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Thank you.
In Africa, seed production has long been dominated by big government monopolies, leaving few options for small-scale farmers and putting more obstacles in the way of food production. But a new initiative hopes to change all that by enhancing African farmers' access to improved seeds. Hilary Hewler has more on the story from Nairobi.
Edward Mabaya grew up in Zimbabwe, one of 10 children. His father was a construction worker, and his mother farmed their land. But Mabaya's story isn't the one of rural poverty many people think of as typical. And he says his family owes their success to seeds.
This is at a time when new varieties were just coming into Zimbabwe. And you saw this huge uptake of adoption by smallholder farmers that resulted in very high yields. And with that money, my parents were able to send us to school.
In fact, all 10 children made it as far as university. Now Mabaya is a researcher at Cornell University in New York, working on a project he hopes will give other small farmers the same chance his parents had. He heads the African Seed Access Index, or TASAI, launched Thursday, which monitors the continent's commercial seed sector to try to get more improved seeds into the hands of small-scale farmers. Africa's seed value chain is complex, says Mabaya, and TASAI tries to identify its weak points to pinpoint why access is a problem. Improved seeds, which have been systematically bred for certain characteristics, are widely used in the West. But until the 1980s and 90s, Africa's seed sector was run by government monopolies, and since then, private seed breeders have been slow to take off. This means that most farmers still use the same seeds they've been saving for generations, says George Bigirwa of the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, or AGRA. He says there aren't enough improved seeds in Africa to supply the millions of farmers who need them.
I remember when before AGRA came in some countries like Burkina Faso, like Mali, even Ghana, there were no seed companies. At least today, you have an average of about 6 to 8 seed companies in place. However, looking at the amount of seed each company produces, that is still very little.
In terms of productivity, he says, improved seeds can make a world of difference for a small farmer.
The difference is day and light. If you look at some of these traditional varieties, the yield potential is very low. For instance, maize, at most farmers can get 1 ton or 1.5. But if they use these improved varieties, which have got disease resistance, some of them are drought tolerant, you can get 5 to 6 tons per hectare.
This can be enough to help lift subsistence farmers out of poverty, explains Mabaya. Not only that, he adds, but new factors like climate change mean that some older seed varieties aren't performing as well as they used to.
Farmers are facing challenges that they did not have to deal with, you know, only, you know, 10 years ago. So some of the varieties that farmers were growing are not doing well anymore. We have also new diseases that have come into the market, and you need new varieties that can resist some of these diseases.
Africa's seed industry still has a long way to go, says Mabaya. But with access to the same agricultural technology the rest of the world is using, he says, there's no reason why the continent shouldn't be able to feed itself. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
As Nigeria heads to the polls March 28th, Voice of America reporters head to the field, covering the election campaigns and the issues for Nigeria and all of Africa. Turn to Voice of America for the facts. Nigeria Decides 2015. What happens there matters throughout Africa. VOA has the largest team of international journalists in Nigeria and surrounding countries, counting down to the March 28th election and beyond. VOA's Nigeria Decides 2015 coverage is on radio with Daybreak Africa, Africa News Tonight, and Nightline Africa. On television with Africa 54 and Straight Talk Africa. And stay on top online. Go to voanews.com. Special Nigeria Decides 2015 coverage is underway now. A commitment to Africa from Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Cameroon military sources say Boko Haram fighters have killed civilians in four Nigerian villages. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Egypt for an economic summit. And the European Union announces a pilot effort to dismantle human trafficking of African migrants. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa. And in our feature segment, the final part of a series on South Africans with life-threatening diseases. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Kim, and happy Friday to all our VOA listeners.
Well, Sunny, I understand your opening serve is women's tennis.
Kim, let's begin with Serena Williams, the world's top-ranked women's tennis player. Serena is in Southern California for the annual Indian Wells Masters Tournament. It's the first time Serena has played at Indian Wells since 2001. It was that year when her father vowed neither of his tennis-playing daughters, Serena and Venus, would play in the competition again, noting he and his daughters were subjected to racist taunts from the California crowd. Serena won the trophy that year, but said she felt no happiness about it at the time. Serena says she feels the time is right for her return.
Well, it was just a really good opportunity for me. I just felt like it was time. There's nothing, there's not one thing that says I should come back. I should come back in 2015. I didn't even know I'd be playing in this year. But it was more or less just timing. I just kind of felt it. I just felt like everything was a right time for me to just come back and try to do the best that I could here again.
Serena Williams says there's also a lesson about forgiveness in her return to the Indian Wells tournament.
I was taught when I was young to always forgive and to always, you know, try to look at the bigger picture, so to say. So with that being said, I think it's been a good opportunity not only for me to be here, but also like I was able to raise awareness and for charities like EJI and the Equal Justice Initiative, and just, you know, point out different things that you can be better, you can overcome things even though they might not be the best of situations. It depends on how you look at it and how you can overcome them.
Serena Williams received a first round bye in Indian Wells. She'll begin play later Friday night with a second-round match against Monica Niculescu of Romania, who is currently 67 places behind Serena in the women's rankings. Still, Serena says she's a bit nervous ahead of the match.
I think there will be added nerves. I would really not be telling the truth if I said that there wasn't. And, you know, to be honest, I was a little nervous to come out here. You know, in the beginning, I was like, what was I thinking? You know, but I kind of had to overcome that hurdle. You know, I spent a day extra in L.A. I was like, you know, I'm not ready yet. But I kind of just had to just overcome that. And then once I got here, everything has been really amazing. Everything has been really great. So I'm looking forward, actually, to kind of stepping out on center court and letting the whole world know that it doesn't matter what you face, whether it's something that wasn't right, something that hurt you, hurt your family, you can just come out and be strong and say, I'm still going to be here, I'm still going to survive, and I'm still going to be the best person that I can be.
That's Serena Williams, the world's top-ranked women's tennis player, and Serena was speaking in Indian Wells, California.
Hello, sports fans. This is Michael Chang, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
African football news now on the Voice of America. Zimbabwe has been expelled from 2018 World Cup qualifying for failing to pay a former coach. Michael Cariati reports from Harare.
The International Football Controlling Body expelled Zimbabwe from the qualifying rounds of the competition ahead of the 2018 World Cup in Russia over an outstanding debt. FIFA said in a statement, Zimbabwe owe, I quote, an exceptional debt to former national coach Brazilian Jose Claudino Valenos. FIFA ordered Zimbabwe to settle the debt in 2012 but nothing has materialized to that. The money goes back to Valinor's work with the warriors since 2008. First, Zifa were given 30 days to settle the debt. The time was extended to 2 months, but even after 3 months' extension, the local football association failed to honor the debt, leaving FIFA with no choice. The Zimbabwe Lifelong Footballers Trust has been quick to react, demanding that the whole FIFA assembly should resign in the wake of this disaster. The decision by FIFA has left the whole country, a football-loving nation, shell-shocked. Lifelong Footballers Trust member Chris Sambo said this was a national disaster to allow our team to go without World Cup participation. Women's football follower and supporter of New Orleans, Christine Matienga, also joined the bandwagon, saying Zifa have been a disaster.
Zifa has killed our football. They must go. We don't need them.
Matienga said the Zifa executive should resign today.
They must go.
An aspiring footballer, Lars Jackson, says he's saddened by the latest development.
I am saddened. This is not good for our football.
Another football supporter, Perfect Murimba, also added his voice that if he had a choice, Zifa would be disbanded, adding the Minister of Sports was right in asking the Zifa board to go. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Kariati.
Thanks, Michael. Just ahead on the Sunny Side of Sports, the VOA's Tef Tef and Downtown Brown will have our English Premier League football question of the week.
The Voice of America.
Hey, this is VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef Tef.
So the question of the week, we had this talk last week of Arsenal playing against Manchester United. So we decided to throw a question out there for this week. And the question was, Downtown Brown, Gunners beat Red Devils 2-1. So all Arsenal fans stand up. And so how do you feel about this game, Manchester United versus Arsenal? Do you blame the ref? Do you blame Manchester United's defense? Or Arsenal got lucky? So, Tef, I don't know what to say. Looks like my team won. My team won. All Arsenal stand up. Round of applause, all Arsenal fans. The first comment, bravo to Alex Bello. I want you to pour me a glass, too. I'll be waiting, okay? Just let me know when it's there, okay? That's a perfect, perfect comment.
Once every 10 years, guys. That's how often it happens. Enjoy the drink.
So, Tef, there's two people that you wanted to talk about.
So the first one that I got an earful of this after the game was over, and it was people talking about, you know, Van Gaal's tactics. And Toto Garcia said it's the poor tactics that Van Gaal applied in the game that led to his exit from the FA Cup. These include poor substitutions, poor formation of the squad, and poor positioning of Wayne Rooney. I don't want to say I completely agree, but I will agree on maybe one point, which is maybe Herrera's substitution at halftime. Otherwise, to be honest, I think he made some good decisions, assuming, you know, Van Persie's not available.
Because if Herrera stayed in, he would have easily got a red card because he was playing very aggressive against all the...
But he's a small guy. I think he would have gotten away with it. Fellaini was playing more aggressive, in my opinion, and very he was true. Lucky to stay on the field because he fouled a lot. But, I mean, you can't position Rooney anywhere else, especially the past few games. He's been good, you know, going forward and scoring. So,
I mean, Manchester United's defense was holding up very well, like for a little bit of the game. Because
First half was great.
Amazing. Yeah. I'll give you guys that. But you can't throw much on Valencia. That's just a bad pass back.
Exactly. And that's why the question, by the way, this kind of answers Solo and Solo Obiagu and Kali Gwegwe. They both complained about the question we posted saying, you know, poor and biased question. He said, are you disappointed that Manu lost? Or Solo said, the question is wrongly framed. It says it reflects an impossibility for Arsenal to beat Manu. It's not because it's not impossible for Arsenal to beat Manu, although they haven't done it at home since 2006.
Hey, if I can pay the refs off, I think can too.
No, but we were just trying to say that, you know, you saw the mistake by Valencia, and that's what ultimately cost the game.
for Manchester United. So and that was a great win. Congratulations, Arsenal fans, by the way.
The one thing I don't understand is you guys picked up Falcao and didn't even play him in a prime match. You guys should have easily used him once Di Maria came off.
Sure, and that's the biggest criticism that Van Gaal is getting. But if you look back at the game, what happened was Di Maria got sent off after we finished our last substitution, which was Yan Uzai, who came on. I think Van Gaal would have gone for Falcao had Rojo not got carded for that nasty tackle on, I think, Cazorla it was. So right. Once he got that yellow, he had to take him out because he did not want to get a red. Unfortunately, Di Maria ended up getting another red through his own mistake.
Yeah.
So, great win. Anyways, tough loss for Man U fans.
So, all the Man U fans, I want you guys to grab a cup of some sort of Haterade. Just take a sip of it right now.
We'll see you at home. We'll see you at the Emirates. And we'll hopefully, the ref will hold it down there.
So, games to watch over the weekend. Manchester United versus Tottenham. Chelsea versus Southampton.
And Arsenal versus West Ham.
So, moving on to news. PSG went against Chelsea, and Chelsea lost in a 2-2 tie.
Yep. I think the aggregate was 3-3. PSG goes through having scored two away goals. That was a beautiful game. Just shout out to the two Brazilians who came through, especially playing 90 minutes with 10 men.
Yeah.
That's not a good sign for English teams.
I think a lot of Brazilians probably have a little surgery on their forehead because that's...
Especially the defenders. Yeah. Those are two brilliant headers.
Now, I want to point this out. This is not the first time, but the second time. You have Danny Welbeck and now David Luiz celebrating on an opposing team. Is that right to do that? A lot of times you see a lot of teams or their players don't celebrate that much when they score a goal.
I mean, I don't blame... To be honest, if they want to celebrate, it's just their right. And especially in the case of these two players, it's not like these players were born and raised in that. I mean, Welbeck was tied with Manchester United, but, Manchester United let him go. And, he has every right to celebrate. For example, Van Persie didn't do it because he knew going from, Arsenal to Manchester United that he had been at Arsenal for God knows how long, and he was supposed to be one of their, best players. And he just couldn't celebrate it. Same with Lampard scoring for for City against Chelsea.
Yep.
So I think if you're a legend in the club or at the club, then usually you probably are old enough to not do it.
Yeah.
But in the case of Luiz and Welbeck, they're just professionals, playing with different teams now.
So coming up this summer, July 15th and 18th, teams that are involved in it are Arsenal. Let's go. Stoke City, Everton, and then Singapore's 11. So I'm VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef Tef.
Have a great weekend, you guys.
You have a great weekend, too, guys. And wishing all our Voice of America listeners a great weekend. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, sending it back to Yehaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays like today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the final part of a series on South Africans with life-threatening diseases. And next, rappers contributing to democracy and dialogue in West African countries. But first, some music. Here is South Africa's Zahara with Amutawalo. South Africa's Zahara with Amutuwalo.
Well, South Africa remains the country with the highest number of people with HIV in the world, 6 million according to the United Nations. Yet it's made remarkable strides against the disease in recent years. The government is giving life-prolonging antiretroviral or ARV drugs to almost 3 million people. But state data shows tens of thousands of people continue to die of HIV-related sicknesses every year. They don't stick to treatment regimens or they don't get tested for HIV, preventing them from accessing medicine. However, some South Africans show great determination to survive. Darren Taylor reports in the final part of a series on South Africans with life-threatening diseases.
Job Mohalelwa listens to the radio inside his shack in Munsiville, a poor township west of Johannesburg. The thin 40-year-old wears a striped jersey that's much too big for him. Mohalelwa grins white and wide, showing a huge gap in his front teeth. But just a few months ago, he feared his smile had faded forever.
If I want to go to the toilet, I can take something like 30 minutes to go to the toilet because I have to wait for someone to come and just lift me to go up to the toilet and to come again up until here. And my feet also, it was so pain, so I couldn't even walk like this.
Mohalelwa was so weak that his wife had to carry him to bed. He says, I was a baby again. I was no more a man. I wanted to die like a rat.
I just felt that maybe, oh my Lord, just take me because I can see that I'm no longer important to this world. I'm no longer important. So will you just take my soul? At least, my God.
Because Mohalelwa had long suspected he was infected with HIV, but he was too afraid of being tested, too afraid of the stigma that so often accompanies having HIV. Eventually, a dying Mohalelwa allowed nurses to test him. He was indeed HIV positive, but the nurses showed him how to take ARVs at the same time every day to boost his immune system and prevent him from contracting sicknesses that could kill him. They continue to monitor his health.
Once they are here, I like their smilings. That's why I say, I'm very happy to see them here again. I was so sick, but for today I can tell you that I'm all right, I'm healthier. I feel stronger because of their motivation. Yeah.
Mohalelwa cooks on a small gas stove and reflects on being resurrected from the dead, as he puts it.
I was so thin. I was weighing 41 kg, but for now I'm weighing 65. I recovered a lot. I'm going to live. I can even reach up to 6 years. I'm so motivated now.
Now he grows and sells vegetables. He's working again, repairing household appliances. Best of all, says Mohalelwa, he's once again part of his local choir.
Modimo wa boikanyo.
He sings a hymn for passers-by in the dust outside his home. Across Johannesburg, in Soweto, Maureen Mabuza sits in the sun outside her shiny silver shack. A few meters away, a group of men and women sit on empty crates. Music blasts from a battered radio as they gulp from bottles of beer. Mabuza mutters, I want to leave this place. The people here are always drunk. It's not safe for me and my kids. Like Mohalelwa, Mabuza almost died recently because of her denial that she had HIV.
I was lonely, and when you have no one, the pain become worse, you become very ill. I was very, 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 very sick.
The single mother says a relative then dragged her to hospital.
I stayed there for 3 days and then the doctor chased me. She said to me, I look like a dying person. They couldn't help me.
Mabuza returned home to die, to her room barely big enough for the bed she shares with her 3 teenage children.
I could feel that I was going to die. Even my children was telling me that I used to tell them that I was seeing myself in hell, I would see heaven.
Nurses from a local hospice visited her and tested her for HIV. She was infected. Mabuza says they put her on ARVs, even though they were convinced she would die. A few months later, she's well enough to sweep her room.
I'm feeling great. I'm okay. Wow. Yes, you can see.
Yes, as you can see.
It's clear, though, that untreated HIV has ravaged Mabuza's body. There's a dull emptiness in her eyes. She moves very slowly. She rummages through a plastic bag, shows off some creations completed before she became ill. A floral tablecloth, embroidered shoes, beaded table mats. Mabuza says she can't make crafts anymore because her hands shake too much. Then she whispers, "But at least the shaking proves I'm still alive." I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
After their success in Senegal, two rappers of Journal Rap now sing the news and make political commentary in other West African countries. The Open Society Foundation sent them to train Ivory Coast musicians in Abidjan. Next, they're off to Niger to help launch that country's version of the show. Senegalese rapper and Journal Rap co-founder Shiki Sini tells Ricky Shryock he hopes to contribute to democracy and dialogue in more West African countries.
We just wanted to reproduce the experience we had here in Senegal in other countries. But we had to choose two countries to begin with. We had Ivory Coast and Niger. Ivory Coast because they just came out. This is long years of political troubles, of war. And now they're reconstructing. One of the main things they need right now is dialogue, you know. And for what happened not to happen again, it is important that the civil society, that artists are expressing themselves, giving their opinion on what is going on in the country, especially in when it comes to politics.
The first episode of Ivory Coast's version of Journal Ape just came out. What was the reception like for the very first episode?
People were surprised. When we talked about the workshops in Abidjan, a lot of people thought that it would be like the Senegalese Journal Rapé. It is somehow. It's a formula. It's just a formula we're applying in Ivory Coast. But then, during the workshops, one of the main things we insisted on is make it yours. Make it sound. Make it in the visuals even. Make it something Ivorian. Because the most important is not the music, the most important is the message when it comes to Journal Rapé. The most important is the role it's going to play. And it's going to play the role of a watchdog, just to give also a different narrative, different from the one which is on traditional media.
So Ivory Coast, you know, they also have an election coming up this year. Is that one reason that you thought the Ivory Coast would be a good country as well to have another Journal Rapé start in?
Actually, when we chose Ivory Coast, we didn't even think of the coming elections because they also got concerns about those things, you know. The issues are really sensitive.
The climate here is a lot more open than some of the other countries, I'd imagine, as well.
Exactly. And, I mean, that's also one of the things we're telling the artists, you know, that we understand that realities are different. We understand that the freedom of speech we got in Senegal maybe is not always in other countries in West Africa. But that's not even the point. The point is just to participate in the walk for democracy.
That was Senegalese rapper and Journal Rap co-founder Shiki Sini speaking to Ricky Shryock from Dakar. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Human Rights Council, or UNHCR, carries out a difficult task. It is responsible for promoting and protecting human rights around the world. In other words, it speaks on behalf of those who have been silenced by their own governments. The United States supports the UNHCR for one simple reason, said Secretary of State John Kerry. We believe in its mission and its possibilities.
We know that at best this council can be a valuable means for reminding every nation of its commitments and obligations and holding countries accountable when they fail to meet international standards.
Civil society is the UNHCR's best ally, said Secretary Kerry. So it is especially troubling that people such as activists, journalists, community organizers, critical thinkers, all of whom reject extreme ideologies, while showing people a way to express hopes and grievances peacefully, so many people in so many places are facing grotesque restrictions on their freedoms and rights from their own governments, including, in some cases, their right to life. In Syria, civilians are caught between horrific attacks from violent extremists like ISIL and a brutal dictator who gasses his own people, starves them as a weapon of war, and barrages them with barrel bombs, among other crimes and atrocities. Tens of thousands of North Koreans live in inhuman conditions, controlled through starvation, torture, incarceration, or execution. And in separatist-controlled areas of eastern Ukraine, men, women, and children are being killed. They're being tortured. They're being raped and sexually assaulted, detained arbitrarily, abducted for ransom, forced into labor, said Secretary Kerry. Together, we have to be the voice for those who are silenced by their leaders. We have to be a ray of light for those who spend their days locked away without cause, many times in anonymity, in dark and dank cells somewhere in the world. We have to be the source of hope for those who fear that their suffering may never end or never even be recognized. This is the kind of organization, this council, that the world desperately needs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nigeria heads to the polls March 28th for a landmark election. What happens there matters throughout Africa. Turn to Voice of America for the facts. VOA reporters are in Nigeria and surrounding countries covering the campaigns and the issues and counting down to the March 28th election and beyond. Special Nigeria Decides 2015 coverage is underway now. A commitment to Africa from Voice of America.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.